We do.
Who?
We do. Yeah, we do.
432, but we can't adopt it yet. Just
why don't you do that? Chair.
Hey. Gavel.
I said it's
starting.
It's rather on.
3, 4, 6.
I would agree.
Need one more.
Sorry, Mr.
Chair. Oh, it's all.
Yeah. Here's your fifth.
That's what I told you, though.
All right.
I find something.
We will call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division together for Wednesday, March 25th. We have several bills, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 on our agenda. We're kind of trying to get people ready for the rush after break, where we'll have even more than that. With that, we start out with Senate File 432. This is MFIP General Assistance Cash Grants Increase. I will say at the outset, we did hear a smaller version of this, so we're pretty well versed on the topic. This is a much larger approach to a similar issue that we've heard already. So if we could keep the testimony to a brief 2 minutes apiece, that would be very helpful to the committee. That said, Senator Eaton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 432 doubles the MFIB cash grants to families with children. The Minnesota Family Investment Program funding comes through the TANF grant through the feds, which is stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Unfortunately, a great share of this money has been used to fund other programs, worthy programs that need to be continued to be funded, but should be funded through the general fund. This has not been increased for 29 years, and I will let my testifiers here elaborate.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Jessica Anderson. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today in support of this legislation, and thank you to Senator Eaton for bringing this bill forward. The Children's Defense Fund Leave No Child Behind mission is to ensure every child a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start in life. One of the most significant ways we can ensure children have a solid foundation in life is to make sure that their families are economically secure. Unfortunately, nearly 180,000 Minnesota children live in poverty. 70,000 children receive MFIP. This means that 7 out of 10 MFIP recipients are children. The current cash grant leaves a family of 3 at 32% of the federal poverty guidelines. Even including the food portion, that family of 3 would still be left at 58% of poverty. As this committee knows, poverty is correlated with poor childhood and adulthood outcomes. However, it's not solely poverty or the degree of poverty that matters for child outcomes, but when during childhood that poverty occurs. Rapid and critical brain development occurs during early childhood. Around half of children receiving MFIP are young children. Poverty during that time period is especially harmful for outcomes related to cognitive development and achievement skills. From the little data we have on the 35,000 young children receiving MFIP assistance every month, we know they're not doing well. In fact, 61% screened as part of a pilot project scored positive for possible cognitive, emotional, or behavioral delays. But when we increase family income, we improve child outcomes. For example, a 2011 Brookings study examining the effects of family income on school readiness found that an additional $1,000 of average annual family income throughout early childhood results in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. Increasing the cash grant is a long overdue investment in the health and well-being of our state's children, and we ask legislators to take action this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And then you have a couple of additional testifiers, looks like. Ms. Watlow Phillips, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. We believe very strongly that you love your neighbor as yourself. And who is our neighbor? Everyone in this room, including our dear friends that are on MFIP. And that we need to treat people the way that we would want to be treated. And I think this bill really talks with people about what do they need. Now, while Senator Hayden's bill was great at adding an additional $100, and we've already added $105 that'll come into a housing voucher starting July 1, again, the sheet that I handed out is that people nowhere on MFIP can afford housing in our state. And if you still don't have the, if you don't have the piece where you have it by county, I have some additional copies of that. We do know that 36,000 people or 13,000 families applied for Section 8 HRA when that was opened up again, and only for just to get on the waiting list. We know that if people have to go into shelter, it costs us an incredible amount of money. It'll cost between $4,000 and $5,000 a month to have a family in shelter. So last time that I testified, we had 163 families on MFIP in Hennepin County shelters. Last night, we had 187. So that means this month, we will spend between $748,000 and $935,000 on those 187 families in shelter. You might as well double that, because we're going to have to then pay a double damage deposit to get them out of shelter. We're going to have rapid rehousing workers help them get out of shelter into housing, if they can even find housing, because their record, their rental record has now been damaged by losing their housing, and so has their credit record. So we're continuing to put people at a further and further behind when we're supposed to be trying to invest in our families. Now, as a retired psychologist, having run a program for 30 years, Elim Transitional Housing, and working with people that experienced homelessness, one of the things I always told my staff is, if people stop working their plan and stop doing their job training or stop going to school, the first thing you look at under Maslow's hierarchy of needs is, are they having problems with making their rent and utilities? Are they having problems with food? Are they having problems with getting clothing for their kids to go to school? And that's what's happening to our families on MFIP, is that we have great services that we're funding with the TANF dollars. But people, if they're not stable in housing, can't use those services because they're worried every day about where they're going to live and if they're going to be able to keep a roof over their head. So in conclusion, as I said last meeting, just think about sending your child or your grandchild off to college or off to some training. So you're sending them off. They've got a scholarship, or maybe you have the resources to help them pay for their school, or they've got a good student loan to pay for their tuition. But they don't have enough money for housing. They're not going to do well in school. And that's exactly what we're doing with our MFIP families. We've got great services, but we need to have them have enough resources to pay for their housing. So it's long overdue. It's time to double the MFIP grants now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whitelaw Phillips. Ms. Galboy, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Try to keep it to 2, maybe 3 minutes, if you could.
Sure. It'll even be briefer because I have talked to this committee a couple of times on this issue over the years, many times. Yep. My name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee, and I'm really, really happy that you're hearing this much-needed bill to double the grants. Even if this bill passed by itself, it would not represent keeping up with the cost of living since 1986. The cost of living since 1986 has more than doubled, and the grants have not gone up. So we know this bill will, quote-unquote, cost a lot. We consider it's paying back a lot. It's paying back years and years and years of theft. And then in this year of surplus, this is the inflation we should be looking at. We should be looking at the people who are homeless, the people who are hungry, the children who are damaged because of the policies of this state. So we urge you to pass this bill through this committee. We urge you to go to the leadership in the House and the Senate and in the executive branch and say, we need to double the grants, we need to get Minnesota back on track, and we need Minnesota to be fair again. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galboy. Let the record reflect we now have a quorum, and I see, Senator Eaton, you have an A1 author's amendment that deletes a couple of sections, and the fiscal note members have before them is reflective of the A1 amendment. So with that, Senator Franzen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. So now the bill is in line. I do need to say that in Section 5, the appropriation is from the TANF block grant, and currently the TANF fund is zero, so this would have to be a general fund appropriation, and the construct of it would need to be worked on. Were we able to pick it up? But we can work on that over time. We don't have to make any adjustment today. Questions of members? Senator Carlson.
Oh, sorry, I was calling my LA.
Oh, I see those fingers. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could somebody explain again, just for everybody around the table, why there is a zero balance in the TANF fund?
The simple answer given was because we've spent it.
It's all gone. Oh,
it's all gone.
On what?
We did pass out after the last hearing, you know, that rather detailed sheet that we worked on in the task force that kind of listed where all of the TANF funds go. I do know that the tax committee has before them a proposal to free up a significant portion of the TANF funds by picking up the working family tax credit with general fund. I personally am hopeful they're able to find a way to do that. If the tax committee got a target like the House did, I mean, I think that it'd be pretty easy to accomplish. Not sure that's going to come to pass in the Senate, but hopefully they'll be able to free up some TANF by at least that mechanism. And if we can find other ways to backfill current TANF expenditures, then we can use TANF funds to increase the grant, and that would be in line with the recommendations that came out of the task force that you and I served on, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Do you remember how much that working family tax credit was worth?
$47 million.
Thank you.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned, and I think I remember Senator Hayden's bill. And that was 100. Do you recall what the fiscal note on that was? I know that might be asking because it's not in front of us and hasn't been in a while, but obviously it was significant.
Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, the governor's proposal is a $100 per month increase, and that's about $68 million.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
We laid that over for possible inclusion.
Yes, we did.
And the intent is to lay this over to
that would be the intent.
Potentially. Put them all in the mix, I guess. Maybe
they will all be on the table.
All right, thank you.
Is the intent. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 432? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be brief. I'm Anna Ashby with Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Prosperity for All Coalition. Prosperity for All is comprised of over 70 organizations that support an increase to the MFIP cash grant. Many of these organizations work with the 28,000 families on MFIP and see the immense need for a cash grant increase to accommodate rising costs in housing, transportation, and other basic needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 432? Welcome to the committee. Please keep your comments brief.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Darnella Wade. I'm also from the Welfare Rights Committee. Thanks for inviting me to testify in favor of Senate File 432. To double the grant to Minnesota would be a powerful and progressive move for the people of Minnesota, the people that consist of the children of Minnesota. 29 years is a long time to fall behind the cost of living. Our country is experiencing hardship, but Minnesota is in a surplus. Just doubling the grant to Minnesota could allow a family to pay the monthly rent at best. The number of women in working in Minnesota supersedes the percentage of women working nationwide. These laws have been overlooked for an extensive amount of time, and now it has become neglect on the cares and quality of the lives of 70,000 children in Minnesota that live here in extreme poverty currently. We ask for you to contribute back into the working class families with dependent children in Minnesota, and not only are they our future, but they're your future. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other testimony from the public? Seeing none, any other questions from members? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to reiterate a bit of the outrage over where we're at with the TANF grant. I, too, am baffled why it's at zero balance. It's funded for this purpose to the states. Used to be aid for dependent children. And the fact that we've balanced our budget by funding all of our social programs through the TANF grant once we were given the ability to use it for whatever we wanted, I think does not speak well of Minnesota. We need to find the funding for these other programs, and we need to give these children a good start in life. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, I appreciate that. I'm sorry I missed the earlier part of the presentation, and my apologies to the testifiers as well, whose testimony I missed. But I'm really very appreciative of the effort that you've brought in this bill, as well as those who over the years have come to visit me on this subject. So keeping the focus on this is very important. I just wanted to say in the discussion, I really don't have a question, Senator, but we've made a mistake, I think, by trying to tell the public that by resolving the money that we borrowed from the schools that we resolved our debt and had gotten back to ground zero. We've also done the same to the TANF funds as we did to the schools to pay for other programs, and we haven't paid that back. And so we really should be paying our bills before we start doing unwise things with what we're calling a surplus, which might really be about paying off some of the other debts that we have to these programs.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves Senate File 432 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eaton. And
you
have another bill, is that correct?
Yes,
Senate 238. File 238. Okay. Do you have an amendment with this one or not? It doesn't look like it.
I do not believe so. Ready?
Welcome. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 238 would return the MAEPD program, the Medical Assistance Employed Persons with Disabilities program, back to where it was prior to 2011. With the change that was made that went into effect last year, I've had several constituents call me and tell me that their premiums have tripled and quadrupled. These people are barely making it with working with a disability, and these premium increases are, you know, encouraging them to stay home and not work. When they work, they pay income tax. When they work, they contribute to the community and to their own self's growth. So I think it's an important program, and I'd like my testifiers to take it from there.
Thank you. Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. To set a little bit of the context, this premium increase was adopted as part of the budget deficit deal at the end of the state shutdown. And
I always struggle to find a name for that thing.
It was delayed, however. And the reason you're hearing about it now is because it was delayed due to the Affordable Care Act. So it began to be imposed on people in October of this year. And since that time, we have heard from many people participating in MAEPD that they're not going to be able to continue to pay their rent or pay their van payments or fix their lift or their basic needs and still keep a job. So we are really, really concerned. The number of participants in this program is going down. We're now below 8,700 people. We've been nearly at 9,000, even in a bad economy. And given the booming economy here in Minnesota and the need for workers, this program should be going up every month, and it is not. It's going the other direction because the stiff premium increase really has made it very, very difficult for many people to make work pay. People with disabilities want to work, and given our need for workers and our future demographics, this is an untapped resource. And part of the answer for improving that is to improve this program, reduce that premium. These folks cannot get the health coverage they need from their employers. They can't get PCA services on an employer-covered plan, and they cannot get it on Medicare. The only place they can get the help they need is the Medicaid program, medical assistance. And they either participate in this program so that they can become more independent, which we all want and which they dearly want, or they will have to spend down to 75% of the poverty level at $730 a month. And that just leads to greater dependence. The other point I would like to make is that, to the fiscal note, the state cost of this would actually result in double relief for the people paying the premiums, because half of every premium payment has to go to the federal government. So people are actually paying twice what the state saves or would pay to reduce the premium. I think that's an important thing to remember. So we really urge that you include this premium reduction in your Health and Human Services omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Ms. Schmiel, is that correct? Welcome to
correct.
The committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Erica Schmiel. I'm with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. I'm here today on behalf of Jim Carlisle to read his testimony that he shared with the policy committee. I'd also like to point out an additional story in your packet featuring Mary Richards, who is also unable to be here this morning because she is working. These are Jim's words. My name is Jim Carlisle, and I live in West St. Paul. I am a 78-year-old tax accountant. I currently serve the taxpaying public using the work incentive program called Medical Assistance for Employed People with Disabilities, or MAEPD. While working with this program, I'm allowed to pay a monthly premium to receive medical assistance, including attendant care. These services are essential to my independence. This program has allowed me to accumulate a comparatively small retirement fund, build a wheelchair-sized home, and purchase an accessible vehicle. The real estate taxes, insurance, and maintenance on these assets take much of my modest income. Then, last year, my MAEPD premiums jumped from $43 to $118 a month. That was a 277% cost increase, while my income stayed steady. If these unexpected and excessive premium increases would be imposed on the general public, most people would be searching for lower insurance rates. People with disabilities usually do not have that option. MAEPD premiums must be rolled back to the pre-increase levels. Policymakers say they want to keep people with disabilities in their homes and engaged in the community because it is better for their overall health. This can only be accomplished by taking the legislative measures necessary to decrease expensive insurance premiums to disabled people. Thank you for listening to my testimony. James R. Carlisle.
Ms. Schmiel, I know many of us serve on both, and I remember his powerful testimony well. I'm sure all of us who were there remember it as well. Senator Carlson, we have one more testifier.
Mr. Chair, I want to make
Senator
some comments
Carlson.
On this particular
sure.
testimony. This one is very personal to me because I grew up
Carlson.
With Jimmy Carlisle. I'm Jim to my friends, I'm Jimmy to my family, and I'm James to people that call me for solicitations. But so Jimmy
Senator Carlson to us.
Yes. Jimmy Carlisle, I grew up with him in Rosemont. And his mother was a second-grade teacher when I was in elementary school, and I know him well. And he has been such an inspiration to so many people. And now there's been some issues which cut back on his ability to be really independent. And I want to tell you that this testimony is far more powerful than the page that it's written on. He is a very, very highly contributing member of our community. And I want to say that this is, you know, I'm reading between the lines here, and I see the man that I grew up with and how important it is for him to remain independent.
Thanks, Senator Carlson, for the personal touch. It really was. I don't know if you were able to join us in policy. It really was powerful testimony, and I'm very glad to have this bill before us. I think we do have one more testifier. Ms. Watlaw Phillips again. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, again, and committee members. I'm Sue Watlaw Phillips. I'm the executive director of MICA and president and CEO of a for-profit consulting company called Integrated Community Solutions, also a retired psychologist. I want to talk specifically about two of my staff that are impacted by this. As Senator Eaton has talked with many people impacted, one of her constituents is one of my staff at MICA, and who has been working part-time for us. But as this change happened, she actually had to cut back her hours because she could not afford the premiums by working that many hours. And that's an issue, that we have people that want to work, and we're stopping people from being able to work. And then in my for-profit company, and it's a small business. It's conservative, you know, we come from a conservative perspective, but it's a small business, and a lot of times I will begin people by having them on a contract to start working with us, and people that have disabilities, folks that have been in prison, in different situations, to give people a second chance. And so it's kind of see if it works for them and if it works for us. Well, in that process, Donna, who could not be here today because she worked the closing at another job, basically had a really hard time getting her worker to understand that contracted work, as long as people are given a 1099, is also the same as somebody that gets a W-2, okay? And it is allowed under the current law, but I think we could clarify that. But as her premiums went up, she had to make a decision. Was she going to pay those premiums and get her medication for her mental health issues? And she also has been a meth addict and now clean for a year and a half. Or was she going to pay rent and pay food and have transportation to get to her job? And for many months, she went without medical care. She has gotten that all together now and is working about 25 hours at Dollar Tree. She has a criminal history. She has mental health issues. She has chemical health issues. She wants to work. We can't let this get in the way. My staff person, Carol, who's been impacted by this too, is following our implementation of the Olmstead work that we're doing after it was decided by the Supreme Court in 1999. Now in 2015, we're putting it into place. So she's following what's happening here on the state level and attending meetings. If we want to implement Olmstead, we have to change this because people can't live in the community with this type of situation. So we strongly support this bill and encourage you to make this amendment to potentially clarify the 1099 and bring back the payments back to the pre-existing payment level. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watlaw Phillips. Any questions of members? Senator Sharon.
Ms. Henry, can you remind me what year was it that we implemented this program initially?
We initially passed it, or I'm sorry, Mr. Sharon members, we initially, it was adopted in 1999. So we have had very slow uptake from our perspective, and we really need to do a lot better. Potentially, there are about 100,000 people with disabilities eligible for medical assistance. So we have a lot more people that could get to work and still retain the community support services they need.
Thank you. And one
follow-up.
And what changes did we make in the legislation in around 83, 84, and 85 in there? The piece of legislation that you and I worked on, I can't remember what year that
was. Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and members, we allowed people to keep working after the age of 65.
Yes.
That's what it was. Okay, great.
And that affects Mr. Carlisle, whose testimony you heard.
Okay, good. And so in order, so this would be Senator Lori. My understanding then that what is in front of us is an effort to, again, restore the resources that have been in place that were taken out of this program in order to resolve the deficit. Is that correct? And we delayed having to do this because of the Affordable Care Act's temporary support, but now we are confronted with the fact that this is another place where we borrowed in order to resolve the deficit, and probably another place where we have a bill to pay before we start giving money away.
Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, that's correct.
Any other questions of members? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add that since this increased premium went into effect, we've had over 500 people drop out of the program when we should have had people increasingly joining the program. So I myself prefer to see people working than sitting home isolated in their homes. It's not good for their mental health, and it's not good for our society. So I urge the committee to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 238? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 238 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda, we have Senator Carlson, Senate File 1542, State Council on Disabilities Funding Appropriation. 1524, what did I say? Okay. And Senator Carlson, you have an author's amendment in A15, is that correct?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
This is the first hearing, it appears, so Senator Carlson moves the A15 amendment to bring the bill in shape. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Carlson, Senate File 1524.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate File 1524. A little bit of background. The legislature established the Minnesota State Council on Disability in 1973 to advise the governor, state agencies, in the legislature on public and the public on disability issues. The MSCOD advocates for policies and programs in the public and private sectors that advance the rights of Minnesotans with disabilities. They also analyze legislative initiatives and work with policymakers to convey the impacts of decisions on Minnesotans with disabilities. Senate File 1524 would provide a $328,000 biennial appropriation. Of that, there is a one-time fiscal year 16 appropriation to make computer upgrades and provide cost of living adjustment. The remaining appropriation will be ongoing to fund an FTE to coordinate compliance and provide consultation with state agencies on their efforts to comply with the Rehabilitation Act. The appropriation will also fund an FTE dedicated to consulting with agencies on building compliance with the ADA. The bill will make Minnesota more accessible to people with disabilities. And I can personally vouch on that I've used the MCOD for several of my past bills on skyway access, on a curb design, and also on even trail design for our outdoor trails. The council has been around for 40 years. Much of what the council works on is accessibility issues for the state. They've also been doing work on the stadiums, making them some of the most accessible in the nation. They've reached capacity. These two positions are necessary for continuing to meet their statutory obligations. With me is Ms. Joan Wilshire from the State Council on Disability to add her comments to the testimony.
Ms. Wilshire, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. So you've heard a little overview of who we are. We've been around for a little over 41 years as a small state agency and as your advisory agency on a variety of disability issues. MSCOD consists of 6.1 staff, and we receive $1.2 million per biennium in our appropriation. We cross all aspects of the disability community, from building code accessibility to employment and transportation across the state. And yes, we work on the Olmstead Act as well. We field an average of over 20,000 contacts a year. That's emails, trainings, calls, meetings, town hall forums, legislative activities, and et cetera, throughout our office in a given year. Most of these calls we receive are ADA-related. So therefore, you could pretty much say the majority of our work is around ADA and rights for people with disabilities. Recently, however, we have seen a drastic increase in the demand for accessible communication services as well. When we communicate with our constituents, it must be in a fully accessible format. We serve the general public, architects, design professionals, municipalities across Minnesota, as well as other state agencies in our work at the council. Now, the first position request that you see will make agency communications accessible to our constituents and consult the public and private sector on their accessible communications to the disability community. The amendment before you that you voted on basically narrows our focus down for this accessible communications area. The second position that we are requesting that will increase our capacity and begin succession planning for the current staff person who has been with us for over 28 years, who generally takes the lead on state projects such as the Twin Stadium, the Saints Ballpark, and the Viking Stadium, to make issues more accessible and to make sure everything's inclusive for all Minnesotans. Over the last year, we've actually had to turn down several new projects. One of the projects we really need to be involved in is that's the new Mayo expansion, and we have no capacity to even put that on our plate. So without this position, Minnesota will become less accessible and face possible noncompliance with the ADA. This is especially important as we look to Minnesota's aging population. Next, the $4,000 covers the remainder of the 3% cost of living increase in fiscal year 2016. It is a one-time appropriation. The $30,000 covers upgrades to our computer system. This computer system tracks our agency work, and really it's our ability to serve the disability community. It will also help improve our efficiency and allow us to focus on really what we need to be focusing on. And finally, as we look to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the passage of the ADA, this July 26th, we want to continue to be able to do this good work as a technical resource for Minnesota. So by supporting Senate File 1524, this will really help us be able to do just that. The materials we handed out to you just gives you a little highlight of all the statutes that we work on for the state. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Wilshire. One thing that jumped out at me in your testimony was that's a long list of stadiums. Hopefully, if we get soccer, we don't need another one. any questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't remember seeing Olmsted staff requests come before this committee, but it was my understanding that there were 2.5 FTEs put into an Olmsted implementation office, and one of the requests they were going to bring forward is to have 7 FTEs, one in each of the surrounding one in each of the relevant departments. And so I'm wondering where this FTE increase fits with that. And I haven't seen that request, so I don't know exactly where it is.
Ms. Wilshire?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, great question. We work directly with the OIO, the Olmsted Implementation Office, very closely. Olmsted is actually a part of Title II of the ADA. So we have been working on Olmsted since before Minnesota started creating their own Olmsted plan. And so it's just automatically what we already do in regard to our statutory obligations. And so by no means is there any duplication. And it's just a matter of following in our compliance of the Title II section of the ADA and state government.
Senator Benson, a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Wilshire, I guess if the Olmsted Implementation Office is going to come to ask for 7 FTEs to assist with activities in state agencies, and we're asking for FTEs here, I think the committee's going to have to take a look at where those are best spent, because I don't think your role at the State Council on Disabilities is to make sure you can do your work going forward. But if Olmsted's going to be taking on some of that work. We want to make sure that we're not causing too much overlap.
Ms. Wilshire?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, absolutely. And one of the things to note with when we say we're working on Olmstead, it's just a small portion of this position. It's really minute, you know, compared to all the other, you know, there's five titles to the ADA. So definitely it will be a part of, you know, what we're doing. So good to ask.
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I just had a thought. If the State Council on Disabilities is consulting in the build of public buildings, why aren't they charging for that as consultants?
Ms. Wilshire?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we have in our statute authority to charge a fee. We have chosen not to throughout the years based on, as a public entity, we just felt that it was our obligation to work directly with a lot of the architects and et cetera. And it just has not, we've thought about it, but we just have never gone forward with it. And a lot, another section of it is figuring out throughout the years how we would go about doing that. And it's certainly something we have the statutory ability to do, but we just have not ever pursued it just based on the fact that we are a public entity and want to be able to and work with folks as best that we can.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilshire, would you feel it would hamper your ability to work with architects if you were charging them a fee? Is that what I'm hearing? I'm trying to
Mr. Chair, committee members, absolutely, that can be a part of it. You know, they're more willing to come to us sometimes when there's not, you know, a fee and et cetera. And I think that's part of our workload issue is that, you know, we've developed such great relationships throughout the years. And so they continue to come back to us, which is a great thing, and so forth. But certainly I think there might be less of that if there were to be a fee structured around it. But certainly there's always opportunities for us to look at down the road.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering if the department is here to comment on, I know it's not in the governor's proposal, but certainly want to know if they supported or their position on this proposal.
Yeah, I'm not sure which department would even be best positioned. I know we have the Olmstead Implementation Office, but, you know, DHS is a piece of it. Is there anyone from the administration, you know, speaking broadly, that wishes to offer insights into the administration's position? Maybe we can follow up on that. Ask if the administration has a position. I know it's not a part of the governor's budget. This is coming from the council. Senator Hayden?
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just Ms. Wilshire, just following up on Senator Benson, I think you should consider it. I think you should really consider a consultant fee. I mean, if we're going to be fully integrated and we're going to follow the Olmstead plan and we know how important accessibility is, that also goes, that's full. That's not, so you can't, in one sense, we can't say this is really important to us. It really needs to be a part of all the development plans that we make throughout the state. And then say, but we kind of want to make sure that they do it. And if we feel like we're going to charge them, then they're not going to come to us. Well, then that's not equity that we're looking for. The equity is also on the cost-sharing side. And if you're doing the work and you're helping making this state fully accessible and implementing these plans and we're doing all the great work that you're doing, then we should also have to pay for that. And when we pay for it, it means we value it. So I do think that you guys have to change your mindset a little bit and sit down with your board and really talk about what this would look like. And if for some reason architects or other folks no longer want to come to you because you're going to charge them a consultant fee for helping them design buildings that are fully accessible, then I think that that's something that we need to look at on who we choose to do our work. So I just think you should really think about that. And if we're really going to change our mindset, then the revenue streams have to change as well, not just simply making sure that everything is accessible for everybody.
I think that's a good point. It kind of comes to where do we, as a state, fund this? And I think that when we build stadiums or public things, I think what you're hearing is we'd kind of like to build that into the cost. the ability to make sure that it is accessible, and you play a very vital role in that. So maybe you can take a look at that over time. Senator Benson?
Just Mr. Chair, the ADA is the law. They would have to pay consultants if the state wasn't providing the free service, or they would be at risk of being sued, perhaps by the state or by an individual. And so I think it would be wise for the State Council on Disabilities to look seriously at the value of the work that they offer. And they're saving a lot of cost down the line for these firms to be in compliance. I think you should value your work.
Any other questions of members? Anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1524? Come to the mic. Or the mic can come to you, whichever works best. Welcome to the committee.
How about that? Hi, my name is Mark Hughes. I am a former Minnesota State Council on Disabilities board member. And I'll say this. I've been around private industry a long time. Still am in private industry. Matter of fact, I'm not being paid to be here today. I'm here because I want to be, because I have that much confidence in the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. I served there 12 years. And we've accomplished a lot of things. If there was anything that I would say to the left of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities, it doesn't have enough people in the office. I think we could go a lot further if we had more people in the office to do what we could do. Now, as to say that we should charge or not charge, the decision isn't mine anymore. I'm just here to tell you what a great organization it's been. I've sat on a lot of boards. I'm still in private industry and still sit on some boards. It's one of the best boards I've been on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Any other further testimony? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves Senate File 1524, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Franzen, Senate File 1527. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1527 deals with Gillette Children's Specialty Care outpatient reimbursement rates. And Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare has been helping patients overcome barriers since 1897. And that's when it became the nation's first hospital serving children who have disabilities and complex medical needs. Gillette's focus on children who have disabilities and complex medical needs continues to this day. Rather than expanding to provide care for all patients' pediatric conditions, Gillette remained committed to treating this defined patient population. Gillette treats patients for conditions such as cerebral palsy, complex orthopedic conditions, neuromuscular disorders, and other related conditions of the brain and nervous system. This focused approach to care is invaluable to our entire community in our state, not only in St. Paul, where the main hospital is based, but also in Gillette's 18 outpatient clinics located in 14 communities, including in my community, the Gillette Minnetonka Clinic, which offers visits with specialty pediatric physicians and nurse practitioners, and also Gillette Minnetonka Therapies, which offers physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech and language therapy. The Gillette's Lifetime Clinic in Senator Hurst community provides outpatient services for teens and adults who have disabilities and complex conditions that begin during childhood, and Gillette recently opened a clinic in Mankato in Senator Sharon's community. And there's a map in your packets along with other information about Gillette, which really showcases a statewide coverage of the system. This bill would raise Gillette's outpatient rates by 90% with the goal of raising their total reimbursement rate under medical assistant fees for service from 44% to 62% of their costs. Gillette serves one of the highest MA populations in the state, with over 50% of patients served on MA. 70% are fee-for-services versus PMAP, and the majority of services are outpatient versus inpatient. The bill specifically, members, makes three changes to achieve this rate increase. Number one, it increases payment rates by 90% for physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech pathology and related services provided by these specialty hospitals. Second, it increases payment rates by 90% for outpatient hospital facilities, medical supplies, and certain durable medical equipment, prosthetics, and orthotics, and laboratory services provided by the hospital. The bill states that these increases would not impact payment adjustments for managed care or county-based purchasing plans. And finally, members, the bill would exempt physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech pathology, and basic care services from the requirement that MA payments rates not exceed the Medicare payment rate for the same services. With me this morning, I have a few testifiers from the Gillette facility system, Dr. Stephen Koop from Gillette, who's Gillette's medical director, and Gillette's president and CEO, Barbara George. And then we also have the CFO, Mr. Jim Hadiken, who would stand for questions if members have any specifics as well.
Mr. Koop, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Stephen Koop. I am a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, and it's been my privilege to serve as the medical director of Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. For over or nearly 30 years, I've worked with some incredible and amazing children and their families, and I've learned to appreciate the challenges they face and their fortitude in the face of those challenges. Healthcare has really changed. Its emphasis is moving away from hospital-based acute care interventions to a newer model of healthcare, community-based and outpatient. This model emphasizes ongoing care that sustains life at the highest level of quality possible for each child. It utilizes proactive, integrated, and collaborative outpatient care to prevent development of further problems. On occasion, hospitalization is still required for medical and surgical interventions to address acute problems associated with illness and disability. The aim of these efforts is to support and sustain an individual's physical, social, and mental health and well-being. At Gillette, this has been our focus since 1897, to provide a continuum of care that ensures patients and families will be able to engage in life and in their community at the highest level possible. As I like to say, our sole purpose is to serve our patients. Our patients have complex medical conditions, such as cerebral palsy, that require treatment by several medical specialists. Because of this, we have developed a patient-centered model that calls for collaboration across Gillette providers and service. During one outpatient visit, a patient may see multiple physicians and other providers. For example, a patient who has cerebral palsy might require a visit with a neurologist, a pediatric rehabilitation specialist, neurosurgeon, and an orthopedic surgeon like me. Nurses serve a critical role coordinating this care, and the care team also includes therapists in physical and occupational therapy, as well as technical staff that assist with devices, prosthetics, and orthoses. Seeing all team members during one visit improves care coordination and allows families to be effective participants in the plan of care as it develops. During same-day appointments, we're able to provide multiple procedures when these are required under anesthesia, and this collaboration and efficiency reduces the burden of care for children and families. We deliver more care in an outpatient setting because it's more efficient and it's better for the families. It's also a less expensive means of delivering care compared to inpatient care. And that's why Gillette has developed its 18 outpatient clinics in 14 communities, serving children from every county in Minnesota. Because of this, families are required to travel less often and are able to stay closer to home, to school, and to work. This care model also reduces hospital readmissions. By carefully preparing our children for hospital care and then carefully planning their return to home, Our 30-day readmission rate in this past year was 5.6%, compared to published statistics in the nation of 16.8% for children with the same level of complexity treated at hospitals across the nation. Finally, Mr. Chair, our care model supports the vital role of local community physicians and other providers. Gillette's focus is on helping patients thrive close to home. Meeting that goal calls for coordinated care with primary care physicians in home communities, who then can know that they can always call on Gillette and its staff for support when it's needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Koop. Ms. Jors, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barbara Jors, and I have the distinct pleasure of serving as Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare's Chief Executive Officer. Thank you for your time today. Nearly 70% of Gillette's patients have coverage through the medical assistance program. That means we are extremely dependent on income from the state. Based on the most recent numbers from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, used to calculate the Minnesota's disproportionate share hospital payments, Gillette had the highest percentage of medical assistant patients out of any hospital in the state of Minnesota. Not only does Gillette have a disproportionately high number of patients on medical assistance, but the majority of the Gillette's medical assistance patients are covered through the fee-for-service program versus the PMAP program. The fee-for-service reimbursement rate is generally lower than the PMAP reimbursement rate. Medical assistance reimbursement covered only 44% of the cost of caring for our patients under the medical assistance fee-for-service program in 2012. And we believe that since then, that number has worsened. A large amount of the work that we do is in the outpatient setting. Outpatient rates under medical assistance fee-for-service are reimbursed at a lower rate than the inpatient services. For example, in 2012, outpatient therapies were reimbursed at 19.6% of our costs. Outpatient therapies, as shared, include the physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech pathology required for the care of our patients on an ongoing basis. This bill will increase Gillette's outpatient reimbursement by 90%, which will be extremely helpful in maintaining and sustaining the outpatient care model that we believe is the reason for the outcomes and the reason our patients continue to stay close to home. Keep in mind, however, that this is focused only on outpatient fee-for-service reimbursement. Looking at the entire picture of our medical assistance reimbursement, which also includes inpatient and professional services, if this bill passes, we project that our total medical assistance fee-for-service reimbursement will rise from covering 44% to 62% of our costs. Therefore, even with the passage of this bill, we still have substantial losses when caring for patients covered under the medical assistance fee-for-service program. This bill does not address our additional losses under PMAP. We thank you for your consideration, and we'll field questions as appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Jors. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jors, can you explain a little bit more about your PMAP losses?
Ms. Jors.
Chair.
Yep.
We'd like to defer to our Chief Financial Officer, Jim Hadigan.
Mr. Hadigan, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is James Hadigan. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Ms. George mentioned that this does not cover the PMAP losses and that with fee-for-service is around 44%, it would go up to 62% with this bill. So I was just wondering what the PMAP losses that you're incurring.
Yeah, currently Mr. PMAP, excuse me, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, committee. Our PMAP currently reimburses us at about 64% of our costs. So we do lose money on PMAP. This bill would bring the fee-for-service up approximately to that same level.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question to Ms. George's. About once a day, I need to talk about telemedicine. I was just wondering your thoughts with all the outpatient clinics and the ancillary
clinics that you have throughout the state have, where are you with telemedicine, and do you have ongoing goals, and are you going to be building out in that area?
Ms. George?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we currently serve telemedicine through the Duluth and the Mankato communities. We have not expanded that program due to the funding stream and our capability to bring additional services into other communities. Our care model does include extensive follow-up and for our patients, several visits over several years. So we look to telemedicine to take the subspecialists that Gillette services our patients with to extend their care and provide them bigger access into the community. So as we look at that with our commitment to telemedicine is to look at how can we continue to enhance outpatient locations, bring the services in closer to the community, and continue supporting the primary care physicians that are the medical home for our patients through extended use of telemedicine into the specialty, usually through the hub of St. Paul.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson,
if I may comment, not question, I want to thank the folks at Gillette because what they do is so different than anywhere else. And I know a number of people, both MA and private insurance, who have availed themselves of the services that you provide. A very close friend went all over the country looking for relief for concussion symptoms for her son and went to a very well-known national care provider located here in Minnesota, and they scheduled over 3 days, hotel room stays, multiple invasive procedures, and his symptoms got worse and to the point where he could not function in the doctor's office. And when they called Gillette, Gillette scheduled them, got everybody lined up back to back so that the patient would have the least impact. They let him come in on the fourth floor. They dimmed the lights. They rolled him in. And you, I know you do this every day, so I know you know what it means to those families. But I just want to thank you for putting patients at the center of your care no matter what. During his appointments, he needed another specialist. They called that specialist out of a procedure to see him for 5 minutes so he could be assessed and they could get the work done. Didn't have to come back for an appointment. It means a lot, so thank you. And thank you, Senator Franzen, for advocating.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Benson, thank you for that story, sharing that with the committee. It's really about access to care, and you've hit on one of the issues. This is a world-renowned organization that's been treating patients not only in our state, but also people come from all over the world to receive these services. So it's about access, and certainly we want them to continue to provide the service. So I really urge you for your support this morning to consider this bill.
Is there any further questions of members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1527? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves Senate File 1527 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Franzen. Next is Senate File 902, Senator Eakin, State Quality Council. We have a preliminary fiscal note being handed out, so it's not going to go. So this is a preliminary fiscal note, so it's private and we're not.
Mr. Chair, shouldn't be distributed to the public. The reason it's preliminary is because the fiscal note for this bill was also signed to the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Advocate, or Council rather, and they haven't completed their part of the fiscal note, so this only reflects the DHS part.
DHS staff can address it.
With that, Senator Eakin.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill, we do have an amendment also, just a technical amendment suggested by the reviser to correct a cross-reference, and that would be the A3 amendment.
We don't have that in the packet. Oh, it's
I have an A3.
No, here it is. Okay, I got one. So this is just a technical. That's enough of an explanation for me. Any questions of members? It's not an author's amendment because we've been heard. But seeing none, Senator Eakin moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill deals with the State Quality Council, which is charged with improving the state system for ensuring services for persons with disabilities are of the highest possible quality. This will be done by implementing a statewide quality improvement system. The Council is committed to a quality system that is person-centered, quality-driven, data-driven, outcome-based, and effective in its use of public funds. The State Quality Council received startup funding in 2011, but was not funded in 2013, but it has continued to be supported by DHS over the past 2 years. The State Quality Council can be a driving force in Minnesota's compliance with the Olmstead Plan. And by assuring that Minnesotans with disabilities have a voice through participation on the state and regional quality councils, by surveying persons with disabilities, by having persons with disabilities actively participate in setting statewide quality improvement goals, we will enhance everyone's ability to live and work in the most integrated setting. And I think that's the most important thing here, is that you have the voice of those that are receiving these services that are part of the process of establishing these goals. Senate File 902 proposes funding for the State Quality Council, statewide surveys of persons with disabilities, and 3 regional quality councils, which will be made up of stakeholders including counties, providers, persons with disabilities, and their families. I have with me today Dan Zimmer, who is with the Region 10 Quality Commission, which has really, I think, provided a good model to follow for the other regional quality councils that would be established, and also Steve Larson as well.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota and here today as the co-chair of the State Quality Council. Early in 2012, the Disability Services Division convened the State Quality Council, which was approved by the legislature in 2011. The council is comprised of a diverse group of stakeholders, including people with disabilities, family members, advocates, providers, and county and state staff. The council monitors disability services, quality assurance, and improvement practices. It recommends state quality improvement priorities. The State Quality Council developed quality indicators that are used throughout disability services. Quality improvement is a data-driven way to move beyond the basics of licensing standards. It helps communities and providers implement best practices. This, excuse me. This helps avoid problems in the first place and increases the likelihood of positive outcomes for persons with disabilities. The State Quality Council has been charged with defining and implementing regional quality councils, carrying out a community-based, person-centered review component, and coordinating local quality improvement activities. An example of this that could have happened if we had regional councils in place is the implementation of positive behavioral supports. Minnesota decided a couple of years ago as a result of the Jensen settlement that we wanted to move to positive practices for people with disabilities. And 2 years ago, they began this process, and it was to go into effect on January 1st. And we've received information that a number of people with disabilities have received discharge notices from providers because they did not feel that they could adequately meet people's needs. If we went back and we had the regional councils in place, they could identify what are the best practices in positive behavioral supports, which of the providers in their regions are doing a good job, how can they share those best practices, and how can they bring the talent and expertise they need into their communities so that they could support persons with disabilities. Minnesota has made progress in this area. but it could have been managed much better if we had had regional councils in place. To quote Jamie Goodrum Schwartz, Wright County Health and Human Services Director, "This legislation will enable the counties to work in unison with providers to streamline approaches to meet our clients' needs through the regional quality councils." The ARC Minnesota refers to the Olmstead Plan as the voice of persons with disabilities. The goals of the Olmstead Plan need to have a positive, proactive impact on the lives of individuals with disabilities and their communities. The State Quality Council and regional quality councils will help operationalize the Olmstead Plan. There are many noble goals that we support very strongly in the Olmstead Plan, but if we're going to fully implement those goals in housing, employment, in education, and other areas, we need to have local groups, regional groups, working collaboratively to implement those goals. The regional councils can be the boots on the ground that really implement the Olmstead Plan. With that, I'm going to turn the testimony over for more information on regional councils to Dan Zimmer. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Zimmer. I'm the director for Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance, and we are a regional approach of quality for services with people with disabilities. In adding to what Mr. Larson has already talked about, I think when people talk about a regional council, they think of people sitting around a table and talking, and that's a small part of what our region does. Our region is really a way to gather all the resources, all the ideas, all the energy of our community and help make our services better. A concrete example that I can share that occurred through our services was our regional review council put together what's called a barriers report, which was parts of our system that were breaking down for individuals, not by the issue of a service provider or by anything, but just a barrier to them. And some of our service providers took that information, and they were rival employment specialists, employment services, and started looking in the area of transportation. And from those discussions together, from the information that they got from our review council, started to put together a plan and started to work cooperatively with their transportation system. And that was so successful that a third rival employment service provider joined them years later. So now, instead of three different companies bringing three different vans to one house to pick up three different individuals, there's one van that's going to that house, picking up three people and getting them to their jobs that they need to do. The providers are able to save money on transportation by not having three vans. They're able to work cooperatively together and have the end result of getting a variety of different people to work. They've also been able to hire less transportation specialists, full-time people to drive their vans, so they can use more resources in hiring direct support staff. So it's a win-win for everybody. Not to mention the community itself, and that now neighbors aren't seeing three vans pulling up to that house all in a 15 to 20 minute time. There's one van. It's less, it's a positive impact on their neighborhood as well. That's a concrete example of what a regional council can do, and it's time that our state garners that energy of the community and starts looking proactively at solutions and looking at quality improvement rather than being reactive to things that have happened in the past. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Is there any questions of members? Senator Benson? Senator?
Again, just the Olmstead implementation, FTE, State Council on Disabilities, I'd like some sort of view as to how many people it's going to take to implement this, how long they're going to be working on implementation, and if we are ever going to be done with the Olmstead Plan. Is there somebody who has a plan to, somebody who has a vision that we will have accomplished and stabilized, and then we can back off the implementation. So that'll be my only concern going forward, Mr. Chair.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same question, again, similar to Senator Benson. For this one, it's also not in the governor's budget, and I believe this one's DHS who oversees these quality councils, and I understand the importance, especially I've been active on this issue. So wondering what DHS perspective is on this proposal.
And this one, I think this one is an appropriation to the Department of Human Services, so hopefully they will have something to say. Senator Fischbach, did you also have a question or comment? Is there someone from the Department of Human Services that would like to say how this does or does not fit with the administration's Olmstead planning? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services Disability Services Division. We rely on the State Quality Council to help us to define the quality assurance and improvement and establishing quality improvement priorities for our services. They help with the home and community-based services waivers, home care services, family support grant, consumer support grant, all of the services that we provide through the Disability Services Division. Without funding for the State Quality Council, we have worked with the council to identify activities of mutual concern where we can focus our efforts as a state, including identifying individual and system outcomes, indicators, and measures, description of risk issues and choice and options for people in the community, and the plan for the development of regional councils. And again, that can't move forward without additional funding.
It can. Okay. Ms. Hamilton, I don't know if you're the right one to answer this, but I'm having a really hard time reading this new fiscal note format, trying to figure out why there's a $4.3 million appropriation in Section 3 and there's only a $3 million cost. I mean, I see the FFP coming off of that, but that shouldn't. The FFP isn't a state general fund expenditure in my mind. Mr. Albrecht tells me it's okay, but he hasn't been able to convince me yet, and I'm really confused by this fiscal note, and I really do like to understand how to read these things. Maybe you can give us some insights into how this was drafted in this way.
Mr. Chair, it's not me, but I'd like to turn that question over to Kerry Erber from the department.
And Mr. Chair, as Kerry comes up here, I just want to
Mr. Larson
follow up on Senator Benson's question. Just to give you an example, this week on Friday we have our State Quality Council, and we have both the office, Olmstead Office Implementation Director Darlene Zangara coming to speak to us as far as coordinating our surveying activities, and we have a staff from the Department of Human Services coming to speak on how we can work with them better on the Jensen settlement coordination. And so we're going to be very closely aligned with what goes on with Olmstead. And I think there are specific goals, Senator Benson, to answer your question, that are set out there to achieve, and we will be monitoring those on an annual basis and being able to report back to the legislature when they have been achieved and what efforts have been made to achieve those goals.
So, Ms. Erber, just to repeat my question, so in Section 3, we have a $4.293 million appropriation from the general fund.
Right.
But on the fiscal note, it says we have a cost of $3 million to the general fund. And I'm just really struggling to get behind that because I don't want to appropriate an extra $1.3 million of general fund spending when the difference is made up with FFP. FFP and general fund have always been separate to me, and this is not how fiscal notes have appeared before us in the past, and I need to get behind this a little bit so that our committee can do our work. And
Mr. Chair, members, Kerry Erber from the Department of Human Services. So before the FFP, if you add the costs that are gross costs, it adds up to the $4,293,000 that's specified in Section 3. And the different components are included that are listed in this that section in the fiscal note. And because there's staffing in here, or administrative costs, we also have FFP that can be netted against that total. So that's how the grand total for fiscal year 16 and 17 is $3,071,000 after you take off the FFP. And Steve can maybe comment on this too, but when disability services staff gave technical assistance to work on this proposal, they did a report like a year ago or so. That was kind of the idea that these would be DHS staff that were out in the regional councils and the state quality council. So that's why it's built like that. And then just so you know, too, that the regional councils are kind of compounding. So the first year there are three regional councils that are staffed, and there's two FTEs that are with each regional council plus the state quality council. And then the second year they add three more regional staff, so that's another six FTEs, plus there's other costs for travel. And then in the bill it talks about $100,000 for measurable outcomes, quality improvement priorities. So that's how the cost ended up being at $4.2 million for the biennium. So I don't know if that helps, or we can talk further about that.
Well, I mean, I think I could track how the costs add up to the 4.3. I just can't understand the appropriation of 4.3 when the general fund need on the front page is $3 million. I mean, appropriating 4.3 when the fiscal note says you need three, it's this, the interplay and how it's reflected on the fiscal note is what's troubling me. I mean, I have tracked exactly how it's three in the first year, FTEs, and then three again in the second year. And so, I mean, I can see the costs and the way they flow through adding up to the 4.3, but why the bill has to say the entire amount is appropriated from the general fund when the front page of the fiscal note says you need $3 million of general fund in order to spend that 4.3 after you bring in the 35% FFP for, because I understand also that admin FFP is the 35% match, not the standard FFP that we get for services. Maybe that's part of the answer, is that this is the admin FFP, but I'm still having a hard time. I don't want to appropriate $4.3 million if you only need three.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Albrecht.
The difference between a proposal like this, where the FFP is administrative FFP, and a proposal like the one that we just did, where the FFP is for regular MA activities, those are treated as expenditure reductions. Administrative FFP is treated as non-dedicated revenue to the general fund. So when this item gets on the spreadsheet, it would show spending of $4.2 million and associated revenue of $1.2 million for a net impact on the general fund of about $3 million. And on parts of the spreadsheet that nobody ever sees, those amounts are reconciled so that the amount that gets added to or subtracted from your target as you're working to build your bill would be the $3 million.
I don't know if I've helped provide any clarity at all. Members, I mean, I do. It's starting to gel for me. But this is, you know, I do encourage everyone to try to get behind these fiscal notes so that we can understand them. And this isn't how they've been constructed in the past, to the best of my knowledge. And I was struggling with it. I was first handed this morning. And so we'll continue to work through it. But I think I get it. When it's admin FFP, we need to appropriate the entire general fund, and it'll be reconciled with the collection of that 35% admin. When it's standard FFP for service delivery, the 50% FFP does not get appropriated. That's the federal share that will be reflected. Is that okay? Senator Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, are you making the case for a legislative budget office?
Trying to just help people understand what we have before us. Don't know if I've achieved my goals.
Just curious, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 902? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 902, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. Senator Eakin, you have another bill, Senate File 249. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And there is also an amendment to this bill. This would be an author's amendment.
These are not in our packets yet. It looks like
the A1 amendment.
The A1?
I think I got it.
Maybe we could pass out the A1 amendment. It looks like the council summary is drafted incorporating the A1 and A2 amendments. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair. There are two separate amendments, but we're only going to be using the A1 amendment.
Mr. Okay. Chair and
Ms.
members, at the point I did the summary yesterday, I didn't know which amendment was going to be done. So the two amendments are very similar. The only difference is reflected in the last paragraph on the summary, which is the A2 amendment does not include the July 1st, 2015 date in which But I wasn't sure which amendment Senator Eakin was going to.
That tricky little issue again.
Yes.
Okay. But we are not going to offer the A2 amendment. Senator Eakin moves the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin, you now have the bill in shape. Looks like the fiscal note is drafted to the one. We have two fiscal notes. So this is this. We're having the one for A1 passed out. So, Senator Eakin, on the bill, in the shape that you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Mental Health Reform Initiative of 2007 provided a 23.7% increase in medical assistant rates to some of the providers of mental health in the mental health field because they were considered critical access providers. However, licensed independent clinical social workers, psychologists, marriage and family therapists, and licensed professional clinical counselors were not included in the reform. Medical assistance rates have also increased throughout the medical physical health field to providers. Therefore, simple mental health reimbursement parity for non-critical mental health providers continues to be a need as well. These professionals provide an array of varying mental health services and have training and skills in assessing, treating, and preventing psychological, behavioral, emotional, social, and environmental problems affecting the consumers of mental health care. The costs of practicing continue to rise. However, the reimbursement for services are inadequate and unequal. The reform in 2007 left out providers also critical to the care of this population. And this bill is necessary because 9 of the 11 areas in Minnesota are currently designated as mental health workforce shortage areas. And MA patients across the board are experiencing difficulties getting appointments. Finally, this bill will provide parity for mental health providers and help assure adequate access to mental health care for those who need it. I'm open for any questions that members may have.
So, this is a big number on the fiscal note here. $16.5 million.
It is, Mr. Chair.
And growing, 27.5, 0.4 in the tails.
It is, Mr. Chair, but again, it's not asking for any more than what's already being provided to the other mental health providers that did get that 23.7% increase. So,
okay. Any questions of members? Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Okay, Senator Eakin can do that himself in just a second here. Let me open it up. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony in support or opposition to Senate File 249?
Mr. Chair. Seeing none,
any further questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin, I mean, I'm not sure if you can answer this, but I'm just wondering, we're talking a lot about access. would this help with the situation, the shortage of mental health therapist, and has there been any information pertaining to that if there is a rate increase, we would have more access to mental health services out?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Rosen, and
Senator Eakin.
I believe it will. The purpose of this bill is to increase access to mental health services, and I think that providing parity in this situation would help in providing that access.
Senator Benson.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Albrecht, could you help me on page 3 of 5 in the table, the spreadsheet, the line under elderly and disabled basic care, mental health services, that number grows every year. That's just based on our general forecast formula. It's not a cumulative effect. We're adding every year this increase. That increase doesn't get fed into the base, does it?
Or does it? Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, what are the numbers on the line you're looking at?
I'm sorry, mental Senator health Benson. Services, it starts with fiscal year 14, $127 million.
Right, okay.
And across, and that, I just want to know what's generating that growth.
And does it keep growing?
And does it keep growing because of the 20? We add 23%. Does the increase from the 23% then get fed into the top line and keep
increased again
building?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, no.
Okay.
That was the beginning point there. The line that begins with 127 million going across. That's just the base currently in the forecast for those payments.
Okay.
So the amount that gets added is just near the bottom of that block where it says state share. Well, the total amount is the total MA cost, elderly and disabled, $1.9 million, $5.6 million, $6 million, and $6.4 million. And then half of that is the state share. But
so the
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Albrecht, so the 23.7% gets calculated on 2014 numbers, and that addition is added to the 2016 numbers as well? So it's not one time. Is it going forward we're increasing 23%? I know this is a math thing, and I'm sorry I'm not getting it. But
I think, you know, one of the things that would be helpful in this fiscal note, you know, there's not a lot of assumptions that are in here that say why is it growing at this rate? What is behind that? And I think you're trying to get at, is this 23.7 getting added multiple times? Is it compounding on itself? And we don't really have a whole lot of the assumptions that we're kind of used to seeing. Is there someone from DHS who could help us, or Mr. Albrecht, do you have additional insights, or should we ask DHS up?
Mr. Chair, I think what you're asking is if, like in 2017, do they add 132 and 1.9? Is that what you're asking me to get the beginning number for 2017 and then raise that by 23.7%? No, they don't do that.
Okay.
So I think that leaves us still with the question, what is behind this continual growth pattern, and does it continue past the years where we can see it?
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson.
I don't want Senator Eakin to get dinged for something that we're forecasting. His fiscal note is huge, yes. However, I don't know how much of that is under his control because I don't know what that top number is that's driving the 23%.
Right.
That
Mr. Haldeman, maybe you can get us behind this.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson. The number that you're looking at here is the projection for that category of service based on sort of current utilization and then just the growth in the population that's anticipated in the forecast.
That's elderly growth. Why is that two categories?
Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also confused, but there's a line item for each category that has an increase of 23.7. So that under this category and each every other. So what does that mean? Where does that get added? To what total number?
Mr. Haldeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen. That $11 million that you see all the way over on the right, that's the portion of the $127 million that would be applied to these providers in 2014. So they look at a base number of payments to those providers that would be affected by this increase, and that's what that line represents. And that would just get added to the base. Well, sorry, it doesn't get added, but that's the portion that's affected by this bill. So the 23% is counted on top of that line.
Oh, I hope somebody understood that.
Can I,
Mr. Senator Benson?
Chair, can I ask? Was it Mr. Holtgren?
Haldeman.
So looking at fiscal year 2016, the top number, $132 million. Of that $132 million, only 11.6 is eligible for this increase. Is that a correct understanding?
Okay. Mr. Haldeman, okay.
And then the next line reflects 23.7 million, 23.7% of that $11 million. Is that a correct understanding? The $2 million is 23% of the 11.
Yes.
Something like that?
Yes. That's
Mr. Haldeman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, that's roughly correct.
Okay.
So we're going to go through here. You got to work your way all the way through here. And so we're going to have for elderly and disabled basic care, the 23.7 for the upcoming biennium is the cost of increase with phase in, what you see there. Then you got to add the phase-in increase down in adults with no children. Got to add in the increase for families with children, basic care, and you have to add in Minnesota care, and we'd have to sum all of those to then roll up and get the $16.5 million that we find on the front of the page. Is that correct? So now we can at least
there.
See it and understand. All right, that's helpful. Any other questions of members? Senator Hayden.
I guess I was a little premature moving the bill because now I have a question. Mr. Chair, Mr. Holtman. So on the elderly and disabled, so of the 23.7, do we also factor in mortality rates in that?
Mr. Holtman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, no. I don't believe we have mortality rates. I mean, I think that top line, that's just based on enrollment. So the expectation for fee-for-service mental health services for elderly and disabled is in that $127 million and then trended forward. I guess that would be the cleanest way to explain that is that's based on our enrollment expectations for that category of eligibility.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I spent a lot of time in the Pension Commission last night, so it's kind of on my mind. I know
thank
it's a
you
little,
for your service.
A little more of it. Thank you. Trust me, I need a little PTSD from it. Senator Rosen and I were there, but I just think that I think Senator Eakin. I think that that's helpful as we start to dig in because there's this idea that you know we are more people are getting older, but then at some point people. No longer are here. I don't know how best to say that in an eloquent way, but I just am trying to figure out the totality of that as we continue to move forward because it's It's not as if, okay, people get older and then they stay around for another 100 years or something. So anyway, I won't go on, but I just think that that's helpful to try to understand.
You know, maybe on these fiscal notes, you know, if we're going to have these huge multiple-page charts, maybe at least a line number or something so that we don't have to try to say the line that has $29,134,318, I mean, we're really struggling with this new fiscal note format. I know I am. It seems like I'm not alone.
All the time. It's going to be like this all the time.
Yeah, and there's just a lot of numbers to add together and little in terms of the paragraphs. I mean, truthfully, the paragraphs always used to help us understand the assumptions behind the tables that we saw. And there's almost no description in here. And I personally really appreciated that and did go in and read them.
Absolutely.
And try to understand exactly what it was we were looking at. And, you know, getting handed this, this is pretty tough to read and digest and understand exactly how the proposal before us is getting priced out. So we'll have to work through Senator Sharon and then Senator Rosen.
I just want to affirm that for me to be able to challenge a fiscal note, I have to have the assumptions. That's where I always go,
right,
to say whether or not those are valid or other considerations such as Senator Hayden, how is that calculated in? So it's really difficult for us when we're handed these fiscal notes to, what do we say other than that that's the number? And it just really, I think, lays very little capacity in the legislator to be able to influence this process. So I strongly support that we need to, if we stay with this system and not change where fiscal notes are done, that we get what we need in order to be a part of the conversation.
Yep. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, was just going to say this is not, and believe me, Mr. Holdren, this is, positive criticism. This is not user-friendly. And we do love the assumptions. And we also, if you could maybe bold the numbers to that, if Senator
need
Lori
to get
had,
some
Mr. Chair,
together. I missed a couple. I mean,
right,
SNBC, the skilled needs basic care, was not highlighted at all. I guess I missed that one as I went through and tallied the ones that need to be summed, because
right,
even the top line of that one wasn't bold in the manner in which other ones were. There was no separate. I mean, it's impenetrable would be sort of my one-word summary of the fiscal note we have before us. Though it does roll up to a number that catches your eye. I think our point has been made abundantly clear. I think we have kind of worked behind this particular one and understand which numbers would need to be added together to make sense out of this one. But I don't think we're going to be done if we keep getting fiscal notes with this level of detail. You know, we're going to have a hard time getting through our agendas, and that's going to be a big problem for me. So a little work to do, maybe some conversations over the break. I use the term loosely. But anyway, any other questions of members? Yes. Seeing none, anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 249? Seeing none, Senator Eakin, do you mind Senator Hayden moving Senate File 249 as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill?
Mr. Chair, I would be honored.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. Senator Rosen.
What's new?
Senator Rosen, Senate File 1208, is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, Senate File 1208. is appropriating money for chemical prevention programs in secondary schools. As you know, we've had some programs, the DARE program, which was eliminated in 1999, and some of the schools have continued doing that with drug prevention, but it is it's been sorely hit and miss with that program in the schools and how efficient that has been. So other programs now are very costly and perhaps hit some targeted special groups, but leave a large majority of the population out of our young kids. So to summarize, historically, we've been very reactive with our drug prevention programs and not proactive. 15% of the Minnesota state budget is spent on factors associated with addiction and substance abuse, such as medical, law enforcement, judicial. For every dollar, 98 cents goes to pay for consequence of drug use, while only 2 cents goes towards treatment and nothing to prevention. And I do believe, Mr. Chair, and appropriately, I think all of us in this room believe that if we can do something on the prevention side, that saves costs, saves lives, and that's where we should be focusing. More than 90% of the people with addiction begin with smoking, drinking, and other drugs before age 18. I have with me Mr. Dan Kane from RS Eden, who's it's a substance abuse program and sober supportive housing community correction program, and he could go farther into it.
Mr. Kane, welcome to the committee.
Thank
State
you.
Your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N. As Senator Rosen pointed out, I'm the CEO of an organization called RS Eden, which is a multidisciplinary social service agency providing substance abuse treatment, corrections, transitional services, supportive housing, community supervision, and a coffee shop. And we've been doing this for about 40 years. And the point I would make to the committee is that prior to the 1980s, there were prevention efforts, you know, structured prevention efforts in most high schools throughout the state. In the early 1980s and moving forward, we shifted the resources in our substance abuse efforts away from prevention and treatment and towards enforcement, interdiction, and punishment. The result is we now have four times as many people in prisons, both in Minnesota and throughout the country, and we have roughly the same epidemiology associated with drug use. This is an effort to roll back the clock a little bit and structure some preventive efforts on a meager level, in almost a pilot level, to measure the effectiveness of it. We our prevention efforts, as Senator Rosen pointed out, we tend to be reactionary. You know, crack cocaine causes a problem, we become very responsive to crack cocaine. Methamphetamine comes along, we become very responsive to methamphetamine. Bath salts and K2 come along, now heroin comes along, and we respond when the flavor of the month kind of rears its head. And this is an effort to become more proactive, more structured, more planful and thoughtful in how we deal with addiction. Not addiction to one particular drug that is causing society problems at the moment, but addiction in general. How people, you know, get drawn into it, how people can build strengths against it, you know, and how we can move the effort a little bit further upstream. This particular bill requires a match from whomever applies for it. It would require everyone to have some skin in the game. It would allow the Department of Human Services to develop an RFP that would define what, you know, needs to be taught, what needs to be addressed, whether or not the services go beyond one school to a school district or whatever. But it really does kind of change the equation a little bit and roll back the clock to where we try and emphasize some preventive efforts as opposed to efforts once the problem's already been established.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, full disclosure, this is a brainchild of the Chair of Health and Human Services in the House Finance Committee. And I believe this came to me because we were talking in my district a lot of the programs and efforts for this type of program are done locally. They're just assumed in by the law enforcement, by the human services there, and by the schools. We have a huge methamphetamine issue again rearing its head, and it's probably 2 to 3 times worse than it was in 05, the early 2000s. Mr. Kane knows that. And just talking with my local folks, they want to get into the schools. They don't have the resources. They don't have the school officer in the schools. And I know you're thinking that perhaps this should go through at the Department of Ed. Is that what you're thinking, Mr. Chair?
Well, I'm thinking a lot of things.
Yeah.
And now you just added
that. Yeah, I just added that thought. That's great.
You know, I'm somewhat intrigued. But you're saying that folks want to get into the schools. They're not there now. You know, this requires experience, you know, demonstrated expertise and prior experience. But it doesn't do a lot of things. It doesn't say that it's a competitive bid process. It doesn't say that there's an RFP. It doesn't say how many are envisioned. Is it one or is it 10 programs? It doesn't have anything about geographic distribution. It doesn't have any feedback for the results and what's coming out of it, and the way it's structured, it just goes in to the forecast. You know, I don't think we'll ever get any feedback on did this do anything, who did it go to, how did it work, what, you know, I mean, when we start a new program, there's a lot of, and should it be funded out of the Department of Education? You know, and then the requirement, as you framed it, of the matching funds is a little, you know, the applicant has to demonstrate that they have available and will contribute sufficient funds to match the grant. It doesn't say at what level. I mean, those are all kind of terms that make it a little not tied down to the extent that we'd like to see it. Is it a 50-50 match? What is the match? You know, what is the demonstration? I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to say it, but I was thinking it.
Fair enough.
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, do you just save me $5? Because I was going to pay $85 to say it.
It's a long story. We'll tell you later.
So, your fault. We have very little fun. This is good.
Mr. Chair, you are spot on.
Senator Rosen.
And so are all the rest of you around the table. Could we work on this a little bit further? Because your comments are exactly right. This needs to be much more tight.
Yeah.
Right.
Senator Hayden.
So, Mr. Chair, I just think loosey-goosey had come to mind, but I didn't know if I was going to say it. But I do think that there are, I think prevention is really important. Yeah. The older model that you talked about was really more of a law enforcement, you know, the DARE model was more law enforcement, right? And I don't always know if that's the best option. No, we've talked a lot about this in the child protection system, that different communities look at law enforcement differently and they bring a different presence. So I do think that there could be some opportunities for us in this community, in this committee, to take a look at different models of prevention that maybe aren't law enforcement heavy, as well as understanding what schools, because we have done things in the schools, Mr. Chair. I mean, school-based mental health grants that we've given out. So we have appropriated money from this committee to go directly into schools. So I think that there is a precedence that has been set that we could do it. I just think we need to define that, and with the help of Mr. Kane and all of the years of experience that he has, I think there's an opportunity to come with a slightly different model that maybe is a little more clinical around how do you deal with prevention so that it's not simply if you do this, you go to jail or you do this, but it's much more about their health and behavioral and mental health and what substance do to change that in the adolescent development. I think that that's something we could look at.
Well, I mean, that actually brings up one of the points I was making, is that if we're looking at funding a new model rather than what we've done in the past, this is actually constructed in a way where you have to demonstrate experience and prior demonstrate expertise and prior experience. That could be our old law enforcement model would have a real leg up in coming forward. So, I mean, I think right to that point, we don't really know how this would, you know, how these grant funds would be administered. But with that requirement, I mean, we might actually be, you know, making another investment in a model that didn't deliver what we were hoping to achieve. And so needs a little work.
Mr. Chair, absolutely, it needs work. And I wish I could eloquently say it as Senator Hayden said. Thank you very much for that. Because I do believe something like this, what my community is going through, and many other communities, I'm just stating in my little community, they are working collaboratively to bring in law enforcement, like I said, the human services, the treatment community, the schools, the social workers, the medical community. And they're trying to deal with this huge issue with methamphetamine. And just FYI, Mr. Chair and members, in 2000, normally there's about 3 to 4 TPRs, termination of parental rights, a year. In Martin County this year, or 2014, 22 termination of parental rights, all on methamphetamine, all parents, and pretty much 90% of them all reoccurring drug addicts. So we have this wave that's coming down the pipeline. The communities are coalescing. They are trying to collaborate. I'm not even good. And they're trying to work together, yep, to figure out what to do. And I think this is a springboard so they take action on their own also.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kane.
If I could. The point about the DARE program and the police efforts, while they're good efforts, they're not the only efforts that have been done. I mean, prior to DARE, DARE came around in, I believe, about 1984, 85, and there were some very effective efforts in the state, mostly through a group that is no longer in existence. It was called the Minnesota Public Health Research Center, Prevention Research Center. It was in Anoka. And in any event, there's data out there about what is worked in prevention in the past that I think it would level the playing field a little bit for people that are looking to apply. And I can tell you that, frankly, my organization would not apply for this. And I don't think that, you know, it is a treatment issue. It's more of an issue of helping people understand addiction further upstream so that they don't ever have to wind up in my programs. But as Senator Rosen pointed out, in the time that we've basically not paid a lot of attention to treatment or only one prevention program, we've actually the drug problem has become more complex. I mean, we have second and third generation people now that we're having to deal with. And anything that we can do at the front end to combat, in some cases, what's actually happening in the homes in a prevention effort. And there are communities that have been devastated by our response to drugs so far. So, you know, something new has to be done, even if it's back to the future, back where we, you know, emphasize prevention and treatment a little bit more as opposed to law enforcement and punishment, if we're actually going to make an impact on public safety.
Mr. Kane, I think we all kind of agree to that. We're not sure this language quite gets there. That's our main point. So anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1208? Seeing none, any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1208 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
I do promise to come back with some better clarifying language that tightens this up a lot.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen, the last bill on the agenda, Senate File 1229. And Senator Rosen, if you can get done in about 8 minutes,
absolutely.
I will have won a bet with staff, with my staff, that I can get this agenda done in time to get up.
So we have to choose, Mr. Chair.
So help me out here.
Between you and staff,
how much is it?
This is an easy bill, Mr. Chair.
We're going to find out. We're going to find out who's on whose side now. Senator Rosen, Senate File 1229.
Thank you. Senate File 1229 is the EMA legal referral bill. Mr. Chair and members, this bill renews a competitive grant program, which we funded in the last biennium, 13 and 14, to continue a medical legal partnership between the hospitals and nursing homes and legal services organizations. The goal of the grant is to save our hospitals and nursing homes in uncompensated care costs and to help the state avoid high-cost emergency services. In 2013 and 14, the competitive grant, which was awarded to legal aid services, has provided more than 100 clients in 15 counties, including Anoka, Beltrami, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Kandy, Ohio, Lyon, Olmsted, Ramsey, Sherburn, Stearns, Steele, Todd, Washington, and Wright counties. Last year, we had the appropriation of $200,000. We're asking for $50,000 more per year for a $300,000 appropriation. And just a little background on the EMA program. It was under the 1986 Social Security Act, the federal government required states to provide emergency medical services to Medicaid-ineligible non-citizens. And since 1987, Minnesota has complied with this requirement with its Emergency Medical Assistance Program. The federal government and the state share the cost of EMA. And EMA covers emergency and certain chronic care services for undocumented persons, and non-immigrants, which include, among others, tourists and foreign students. EMA primarily covers services provided in an emergency room, ambulance, or inpatient setting following a hospital admission, and number two, situations where lack of care would reasonably be expected to result in emergency department admittance or inpatient hospitalization within the next 48 hours. And with me, I have Ann Quincy with Legal Aid. Mr. Chair, members.
Ms. Quincy, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ann Quincy. I am a staff attorney at Legal Aid in Minneapolis, and Legal Aid is the current grantee under the EMA grant legal referral project. I'd like to share an example. As Senator Rosen described, the EMA referral program does save the both hospitals, nursing homes, other providers, and the state money in expensive emergency care. The example that I'd like to share with you is Mr. Z. He was an asylee. He entered a nursing home after being in the hospital following a stroke. While in the nursing home, his medical assistance, he was on federally funded medical assistance, and it ended during a routine recertification when it wasn't completed properly. The nursing home staff mistakenly believed that Mr. Z, as an asylee, was only eligible for EMA, and they began a long, complicated process of trying to get him covered, his nursing home care covered with that program. After it was denied, his daughter, who was working with Legal Aid on an immigration case, mentioned his situation to our staff, and Legal Aid was able to intervene, obtain proper classification and verification of his status. His medical assistance was restored, and the nursing home was able to be compensated for the 7 months that they'd been waiting for compensation. If I may, I'd also like to speak to how the grant funds are distributed to Legal Aid. As the grantee, under the contract, we have outcome goals and targets for the number of people that Legal Aid will serve. We're taking referrals from all around the state of Minnesota, and we offer assessments, advice, and then full representation to people who are either on EMA or in danger of needing to go on EMA due to an illness. And thus far, we've exceeded the goals of the contract for these quarters, the previous quarters, by serving more than 300 people with advice and assessments, in addition, including the 100 we've offered full representation and obtained a status which, or verified their status, which leads them to better healthcare programs.
Ms. Quincy, thank you for the testimony and thank you for the good work on this program. I'd like to say I've gotten some updates on this program and have been very impressed. And it's more than just getting them access to healthcare, getting them the proper status helps them across their whole life and their family. And it's been one of the real jewels that we came across last time. Senator Rosen, I wonder if you'd consider making a motion on line 1.18 to strike this is a one-time appropriation.
Mr. Chair, I would so move.
On that oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1229? Seeing none, any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1229 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the staff owes me a breakfast. We are adjourned.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.